Good afternoon, Eric Sandler, attorney registration number 32349, here on behalf of Mr. Rutter. I would like to take my time focusing today on the sentence issue in this case. I wish to make it clear, however, that all the issues in the brief we feel strongly about, but I believe that they're adequately addressed there, and quite frankly, this court's going to do what it's going to do regarding what was raised in the brief. But I think the sentencing issue is really important. Mr. Rutter was 27 years old at the time of this offense. He was sentenced to 96 years as a habitual offender for the following crimes: the triggering offense, the manufacturing of a small amount of methamphetamine. And we're talking about a small amount here. The related crimes, which are possession of chemicals and possession of methamphetamine, which we argued in the brief, should have been merged. And the other predicate offenses are as follows: use of a controlled substance, which occurred in 2001, which is at this point in time, which in fact, at the time he was being sentenced, was being made a misdemeanor. Possession of a trace amount of controlled substance, which occurred in 2001, 8 years previous, which at that point in time, that same legislative session was also being made in F6 and was no longer able to be used in habitual sentencing purposes. His first parole eligibility date is June 2056. He will be 73 years old before he is eligible for parole. Thus, he has effectively received a life sentence. While people may think this de facto life sentence in this case is appropriate and is both graduated proportionate under the Eighth Amendment, I disagree. And I hope this court does also. First, we need to discuss how that mandatory 96-year sentence was arrived at. It was first, the penalty for the triggering offense was increased from an F3 with a presumptive range of 4 to 12 years to an F2, which has a presumptive range of 8 to 24 years, because of the prior drug convictions. The maximum of that presumptive range was then multiplied by 4, thus increasing the sentence from a maximum of 24 years to a mandatory 96. Thus, Mr. Rutter's prior convictions, which were already used to double the presumptive range of the sentence, were then quadrupled, so the sentence was increased eightfold for a use conviction and a possession of a trace amount of methamphetamine.
Mr. Sandler,
Are you aware of any cases that have addressed this specific issue where a sentence is in effect octupled because of prior conviction?
I know, and I did not raise that argument because I know that this court has held in the past, and unfortunately I can't cite the case, that is absolutely fine. That increasing the penalty from an F2 to an F3, Then using that F2, capitalizing that is fine. Then that's not an issue. So I don't know of any case that says that's not okay. In fact, I do know there are cases out there, quite frankly, that say it is okay, and that is quite frankly why I did not argue that.
Well, Mr. Sandler, I'm not sure those cases say that we agree that it's absolutely fine, but it is prescribed by the legislature, is it not?
It is prescribed, but whether or not whether something's prescribed by the legislature, whether something is valid under the Eighth Amendment as being cruel and unusual are two different things. And quite frankly, the whole habitual offender statute is prescribed by the legislature. But this court and the Supreme Court, and Darrell A. Gaskins, and I know there are others, still say that abbreviated proportionality review is appropriate to determine whether or not, under the circumstances, that habitual sentence should be imposed. It's a recognition that habitual sentencing is formulaic. I think the word is formulaic. That's what they use. So there's no changing from it, but that doesn't mean it's always appropriate. So I think this court can still look at it, whether or not it's statutorily prescribed or not, of whether or not it's an appropriate sentence under this case.
Well, the trial court didn't have any discretion to impose any other sentence than it did because of the legislature's enactment.
Well, I'm not sure if trial counsel, quite frankly, had requested a proportionality hearing down below, I think the trial court would have had some discretion of whether or not to do so. However, trial counsel did not do so. But proportionality can be raised at this point in time, and that's why it's being raised on appeal. So I think the trial court could have had some discretion and could have found that it was excessive under the circumstances. But that argument was not made down below except for, you know, trial counsel, I think, in sentencing says, you shouldn't do this, but did not request, per se, a proportionality review.
Mr. Sandler, as you know, the touchstone of all of our Eighth Amendment case law is whether the underlying crimes and triggering offenses are grave and serious.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have case law saying that narcotics offenses, as here, are grave and serious. So is there a reason not to follow those cases?
I believe there is a reason, and this is why. I think that's an overstatement. I think when during the time that Mr. Rutter was being sentenced, at that point in time, the legislature was already saying that, hey, these are not grave and serious offenses, and we're making use, a misdemeanor, we're making use of methamphetamine, a misdemeanor. We're making possession of less than 2 grams of methamphetamine an F6, which cannot be used for habitual purposes. So the legislature, which defines public policy, was saying at that point in time, these are not grave and serious offenses. And I realized that, quite frankly, that under the statute, it says that it was prospective and it was not retrospective. But even though statutorily it might have been okay, that does not mean it's constitutionally okay. And I think under these circumstances, to sentence someone to 96 years imprisonment for a use possession, which is a misdemeanor at this point in time, a possession of a small amount, which is an F6, which cannot be used at this point in time for habitual purposes, is under any stretch of the imagination, cannot stand under the Eighth Amendment.
Mr. Sandler, was there a plea offer in this case?
You know, I don't know. I don't know that. I'm thinking there might have been, but I don't know that. I can't say that for certain, that there was. I do not remember seeing one. Obviously, I was not trial counsel in this case, but I do not remember seeing one out there, whether or not the habituals were used to, quote unquote, force the plea in this case. That I do not know. You know, I do not know that.
Yeah, it occurs to me that sentences of this magnitude may have a chilling effect on a defendant's decision whether to take a plea or not. When on the one hand, the defendant has every right to try his case and proclaim his innocence,
mm-hmm.
Seeing sentences like this handed down force one into a plea situation.
Well, it could. It could force one into a plea, and could force one into saying that 24 years is an appropriate sentence in this case, which I'm not even sure 24 years is an appropriate sentence in this case. But it might very well have been a situation where I've seen many, many, many times before where someone's offered, we'll give you take 24 years, or else we're going to quadruple it up, and 24 years to any 27-year-old or 26-year-old is going to seem like a lifetime, since it basically is a lifetime that they've been alive, and they're maybe willing that one time to roll the dice. But it almost seems to me, quite frankly, you know, that the prosecutor has discretion, of course, whether or not to bring habitual charges, and whether or not, under these circumstances, you know, I can't speak to what was going through the prosecutor's mind, and I don't know the prosecutors in this case. But it seems to me it's almost vindictiveness to put 96 years out there for these kind of offenses.
You think it might have had something to do with the fact that Mr. Rutter was out on parole for approximately 1 month when he committed these offenses?
Well, it might have been, but then 24 years might be appropriate, and that's why you would violate his parole. And that's why for the prior offense, you already increase it from an F3 to an F2, which effectively doubles his sentence. And you can impose a 24-year sentence under that. You know, whether or not. But I don't think that in and of itself justifies a 96-year sentence. I mean, we're talking about some methamphetamine kingpin here. We're talking about someone with blister packs of Sudafed in there and a quite crude methamphetamine lab. So this wasn't some big deal. He wasn't out there selling this stuff. It was for his own use or his friend's use. And I think under these circumstances, 96 years is just constitutionally excessive.
However, he was also teaching other folks how to make methamphetamine for $500.
So that was sad. I'm not sure that was proven, and I'm not sure that's the basis for the crime itself. And even so, I don't think that in and of itself would justify a 96-year sentence. If the court doesn't have anything else, I would like to save from the here my time for the vote.
Got five and a half minutes, Mr. Sandler.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Carmen Morley, I represent the people of the state of Colorado. My attorney registration is 34852. Okay. before this court is not a public policy consideration. This is a, what defendant is raising is a strict legal question whether for proportionality review is enhanced sentence under the habitual statute is constitutionally disproportionate. And the question is no. As I say, this is a quote, all drug-related offenses are per se grave and serious, Your Honor. One of the triggering offenses, the manufacturing of methamphetamine on top, is a crime of extraordinary risk of harm. One of the underlying convictions, the possession of methamphetamine with intent to distribute, is a crime of extraordinary risk of harm. So that is telling you not only they are grave and serious for proportionality review, but on top, the legislature considered this crime particularly grave and serious. And the defendant is not challenging and the habitual statute is constitutional. Defendant was had three prior felonies which at all times relevant to his case of disappear were felonies. All the conviction for which he stands convicted are felonies. And again, for purposes of the proportionality, even if this were considered a baby death possession of meth or the use of methamphetamine is not as grave and serious as the other offenses, the inquiry is not whether the specific offenses in isolation are grave or serious. The inquiry whether all of them in combination are grave and serious. And in this case, the enhanced 96 years when considering the seriousness of the underlying and the triggering crime, which again, the manufacturing is a crime of extraordinary risk of harm, does not, the sentence does not yield an inference of gross disproportionality.
Ms. Morales, is it appropriate for the trial court or our court to consider that the General Assembly has reduced the category of two of the offenses that form the basis for the habitual criminal conviction here?
I was doing some research on that and I couldn't find anything. I think there was some case where that was posed, or that was a question before this court, but the legislature actually modified the language or changed the classification of the offense while the trial was pending or while the appeal was pending, and that is not the case here.
Are you familiar with People v. Penrod and People v. Anaya, which were decided by our court in 1994, in which the division said that it was appropriate for a court to consider a change in the legislation?
I am not, Your Honor. But even if this court considered the fact that now possession, simple possession, and use are either a misdemeanor or a felony, a class 6 felony, still, those are just two. We have six convictions. So even if out of those three, we have two with now the, which now the General Assembly considers are not as grave and serious, that would not change the fact that all in combination are great and serious in Your Honor. So we have the offenses that are considered per se great and serious, which include narcotic related. Sometimes or the inquiry to consider whether an offense is great and serious, this court can consider the harm caused or threatened to society. And in this case, I think there's no dispute that methamphetamine labs manufacturing methamphetamine, possessing chemical supplies to manufacture methamphetamines are grave and under the circumstances of this case are very grave and serious. Use of methamphetamine, again, methamphetamine labs. I mean, let's go to the using method. It causes a very serious health effects on people. Its methamphetamine are very toxic places. They create a hazardous problem to the community. It's undisputable or unquestionable that those are really grave and serious offenses. So even if this court considers that the possession or the use are not per se, I think under the circumstances, and also taking into account the culpability of the defendant, who has been doing this since 2001, could consider those grave and serious in this case. But again, it's not necessary to conclude that the sentence is not grossly disproportionate in this case.
Ms. Morley, to follow on that comment, does the change in classifications present us with a responsibility to do a proportionality review?
Well, the trial court did not conduct an abbreviated proportionality review because one was not asked. So you independently can't conduct an proportionality review because the facts, because again, because the offenses are at least, if not all, most of them are per se greater than serious. So this court can do that independent review and also can take into account whether under the new possession and use now that is the have been reclassified in combination, again, give rise to an increase in gross disproportionality, but this court, yes, can do an independent review, and in fact, what wasn't done before because it wasn't requested. Do you have any other questions? The people ask that defendant's conviction be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Marleta. Mr. Samler?
Thank you. Well, first, a couple of things. I don't wish to play down the fact of the triggering offense here of manufacturing methamphetamine. I'm well aware of the seriousness of the crime. And I don't want to be glib, but this was not Breaking Bad. This was a situation where there was a small amount being done. And there is a difference here. And whether or not a punishment of 24 years is appropriate is one thing. Whether or not a punishment of 96 years is another. And I'd like to read something to the court here from a Roper v. Sims, and I'm sure the court's aware of that, when the U.S. Supreme Court said that the death penalty for juveniles was unconstitutional. In the words of the court, it said, it's the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society to determine which punishments are so disproportionate as to be cruel and unusual. As society's evolving standards of decency are expressed through the public policy as determined by society's elected officials. And Colorado's elected officials were speaking or had spoken at the time the court was imposing a 96-year sentence and made it clear that two of those predicate offenses were neither grave nor serious. And we cannot use the fact that Mr. Roeder was convicted of three offenses at the time of the trial. And even if the possession of intent to distribute is considered a grave and serious effect, one prior does not, you cannot quadruple for one, you need at least two. And in fact, that was already used, to say the least, to double that sentence to 24 years.
Well, Mr. Sandler, Mr. Rutter wasn't a juvenile.
No, he wasn't a juvenile.
And so in terms of whether it's constitutional or not, or it's cruel and unusual punishment under our current case law, it's not necessary that we find that it is cruel and unusual to nevertheless decide that we should do a proportionality review.
Well, no, it's not. I don't know if it is, but any proportionality review, and I think if you go back to the earlier, it's all evolved out of the Eighth Amendment of whether a sentence is proportionate. And it's still cruel. You don't want to call it cruel and unusual. Fine, the sentence has to be proportionate and graduated to the offender and the offense. So either way, you know, perhaps that's overstating things, and I'm sorry I'm involved with the juvenile life about parole stuff right now, and that gets on my brain. But in any respect, it's still the Eighth Amendment that controls. And I think under any set of circumstances, that 96 years for the crimes involved here is grossly disproportionate. And in fact, in all effect, just having Mr. Rutter spend the rest of his life in prison not being able to even apply for parole until March of 2056. And perhaps if he's lucky at that point, if he's lucky he's still alive, being released when he's 73 years old. And for that, I would ask this court, and I would plead with this court to please reduce this sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Samler. Thank you again, Ms. Morlita. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.